Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking about, I think, quite an interesting book that does a bunch of things, helps us think about things in maybe different ways, both the past and I at least think there has some use in this book thinking about the future and current events. The book is titled Nostalgic Virility as a Cause of War, published by McGill Queen's University Press, and asks some really important questions that I won't quite give away yet because we have the author here to tell us about the book, the questions and the answers. Dr. Mathieu Grandpiron is here with us to tell us all about the book. Mathieu, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yes, thank you very much once again for the opportunity. So I'm a French scholar. I am associate professor at ISES, Catholic University of Vendée on the Atlantic coast, south of France. And I'm also a visiting professor in Shanghai University of Political Science and Law. I lecture on geopolitics, international relations at École Polytechnique in Paris, at the French Ministry of Defense. And I'm also one of the co-conveners of the British International Studies Association for the working group International Relations as Social Science. And the reason I wrote the book is, well, first of all, it's derived from my PhD dissertation, but I've rewritten it because I thought there was the need to give something different in terms of how we think about causality of war to address some of the shortcomings of the traditional theories that are existing, and as well with what I think are shortcomings in terms of research method of what exists, especially because, as we have all noticed it, especially since 2022 and even more since this October, we are in a changing world. And that means a changing world means we also need new frameworks to better understand what is happening, to make sense of future opportunities, and more importantly, to avoid repeating past mistakes. So that's one of the reasons. And the second reason is I wanted to offer something that I hope tries to avoid cognitive biases that usually exist in most of international relations interpretation that is written in a Western context. So I would say the book is a sort of response to two types of scholars. And by this, I don't mean in any animosity, but it's sort of answer to those who only study foreign policy analysis without looking at data that I think are more accurate, such as primary sources, declassified documents, any document that has been leaked, so anything that goes within the decision-making processes, but I think there's we can talk about this a bit later. And basically, an answer to those who really to rely only on public sources, I found from a methodological point of view to be a bit quite... you can't go as far as you wish if you only have public sources. So that's the book is an answer to this. And the second answer is to those who write about cases with a sort of like understanding the country W, but from his own perspective. I think there is a sort of not always Eurocentrism point of view, but something that does not give always credit to or take into account administrative cultures, political philosophy of a case study. Of course, I don't pretend that I'm not biased at all. Everybody is anyway. because we all have different values, personal histories, and so on, and that shape how we do our research. But I believe, and I really think, that the research method I try to develop in the book can get as close as it can to how decision makers think. And I wish the objective, and I hope readers will feel this way, that the book helps highlighting what is usually unseen unseen because we are using traditional research methods.
Thank you for that introduction to the book, and especially that bit about methods. I think that's so important to emphasize. Given that background, can you tell us a bit more about the questions the book is asking and tell us about how you developed them?
Yes, of course, the first question is quite broad, is what are the causes of war? It's a never-ending question, and everybody has been asking it, especially since the first one asking it was Thucydides with the Peloponnesian War. So that's the very broad spectrum, and it appears in the title of the book. But more precisely, I try to address more specific questions, such as, why do great powers go to war for locations that are absolutely not vital to their interests? So why taking all this risk? Why investing so much efforts and resources for something that has no real value? That's kind of this kind of a disconnection between that. I also try to answer additional subset questions, such as how emotions, understanding of power, status, so what I call nostalgic verity, and I will come back to that later, can impact decision-making processes. Also try to address or answer questions such as, what arguments are used to justify decisions to go to war, both within, during the decision-making processes, so within a restricted audience, head of states, head of government, military, and so on. And then what kind of differences can we observe with the arguments that are said for the public? Are they similar? Are they different? And if they are different, why? Or how different are they? I developed these questions first in the book, both theoretically speaking, and then I ask the same questions to all of the case studies, as to see if there are any differences depending on the context, depending on the country, depending on the epoch, and also try to address answer these questions to current events. The book is mostly about past events, but in the conclusion, I apply the same method to current tensions and situations, of course, with the documents available, so the answers can't be as secured in terms of validity than those I developed in previous case studies. But I try to apply the model to the war in Ukraine and to the Chinese policy in the South China Sea, so basically the militarization of the South China Sea.
Very interesting questions. Obviously, as you said, things that have been investigated by a lot of people, still very much of current interest. So let's get into kind of some of the tools that you're applying to answer them. Can you tell us more about what you mean by nostalgic virility, how you define it, and what some indicators of it are?
Yes, of course. So that's basically the concept that I offer with the book, and I would say, because it took me some time also to figure out how I understood it, but that's sort of the process of writing the book. But having finished writing it, I would define nostalgic virility as a belief system that articulates nostalgia with a virile understanding of what it means to be a great power. So that's the broad definition. And more precisely, I would define nostalgic virility at the very least as a combination of five elements. First element, an emphasis on physical strength, either the physical strength of the leader, and here we can think about Putin and how he uses his body in his propaganda and political communication to show he's strong compared to his predecessors, or it can be the emphasis physical strength of a country. So basically, explaining how strong the country is, how powerful it is, so putting the emphasis on the military. So that's the number one argument and component, an emphasis of physical strength. Then there is an emphasis on traditional virile values, such as being firm, being brave, taking difficult decisions, not doing any U-turn. Third element is the use of narratives that enhance moral and behavioral superiority. So the idea we set examples and models for others to follow. It can be like we have the best political regime in the world. Everybody should follow us. We have the best solution for this. We have a source of inspiration. The fourth component is a positive understanding of a country's history and legacy. And this serves as a reference point to assess and understand situations. So basically, everything is compared to the past, and the past is what we should preserve. So if in the past we were a great power, an empire, we had influence all over the world, that should be the place we should have currently as well. And if we don't have, we should do anything to go back to that situation. And the fifth element is a preference for short time frames of action. So basically, any issue should be addressed immediately. So that's how I would define nostalgic virility. Of course, as for any concept, I don't expect it to be present in all the different cases exactly in the same combination, exactly the same way, but I'm quite confident, as I've tried to show in the book, that nostalgic leaders can be identified as soon as they have these five elements.
Hmm. No, that's very helpful, not just to define it, but to give us kind of things to look for. So now that you've helpfully done that for us, can you walk us through how nostalgic virility makes war more possible?
Yes. So basically, it's as in the definition, it's a belief system. So we look here at decision makers as a starting point. And as nostalgic virility is a belief system, it acts as a sort of filter according to which decision makers are going to assess various elements. So mostly what it means to be a great power, what it means in terms of what I expected of us to do in international scene, what are the criteria our country should have, what is our status in the international scene, and how it should be if we don't have it yet. What are the appropriate response actions we should take to given situations, such as nostalgic virility is a filter that provides the decision maker with an idea of how to react to a provocation, especially a provocation made by a weaker actor. And through this ideational perspective, the aggressor has to be punished, and punished severely, not really because of the act of aggression or provocation, that's not really the point, but because of a symbolic aspect that its aggression or provocation implies. For example, if a weaker power challenges openly a great power, that probably means that in the eyes of a weaker actor, that country is not a great power anymore. So here there is a status recognition denial that nostalgic virility leaders can't bear. Because the consequence of such a challenge is that leaders and or their country, that depends, appear to be weak or uncertain, or I would say even worse, effeminate, or so to say, sort of castrated, if the word is appropriate, and in decline. The image, if you want, is accentuated by a glorified interpretation of the past. Before, we have never been challenged by this type of actor. Now we are. So this, we need to do something about it. And we are going to make an example of this provocation to make sure nobody ever will do this again. So it's sort of flexing the muscles to prove others, competitors, allies, rivals, that the country is not at all in decline and should be respected.
Hmm. All right, that helpfully fills in the concept even more. So let's talk about then applying it. You've briefly mentioned, obviously, that you look at case studies in the book. Can you tell us which three you look at in most depth and yes, how you decided on these?
Yes, so I took three major case studies: the early years of a French war in Indochina, so 1945-1947. I took then the Falklands War between UK and Argentina, and the US invasion of Grenada in 1983. I wanted cases that were in different contexts and geopolitical situations. Why? So that's first element. But I also wanted countries that put in practice a great power, either real great power or perceived, against a weaker actor in an area that was not vital to the country. Because I wanted really to look at why investing so much for so little interest. So that's the first element. And if you take Indochina, you had France versus the Viet Cong that later became Viet Minh, in a context that France was not really in the position to do anything after World War II, right after it. It still invested a lot of money, lots of effort to reconquer, to go against, to reestablish its authority on the Indochinese colony. The Falklands, it's really, it's a long way from Britain, no real economic interest. Britain was caught in economic crisis and political crisis, and still sent the entirety of the British Navy. And for Grenada, well, Grenada is smaller than Washington, D.C., lost in the Caribbean, and Reagan sent aircraft carrier, battle groups with amphibious assault ships, everything. So a true display of power that was probably not required. And in any case, these three cases raise the question, the surprise of why going to war for this? Why risking everything for this? And so that's the first element. Then I wanted broadly three cases for which I had access to internal governmental documents, so declassified documents. For Indochina, all of the documents are now declassified. Grenada, I would say a good 80% roughly, I believe, are declassified. And for the Falklands, everything has been declassified in 2015. And these cases have not really been studied by in the field of international relations. So I also wanted to contribute to this with cases that were largely understudied. And when they were studied, absolutely not with the documents I had. So that was the other reason.
Yeah, no, that I think a lot of us understand those sorts of constraints, so that makes a lot of sense. Speaking of documents, you mentioned earlier a bit about the kind of importance of public versus not. Can you tell us a bit more about the documents and especially how you coded and analyzed them?
Yes. The tricky point when we do foreign policy analysis is that basically it requires us to go within within a decision maker head. So obviously we can't do this. We can't either take the decision maker, put it on a seat on the lying detectors, and question him by trained psychologists. But not going to happen anyway. So all we can do is looking at what they produce, speeches, written documents, and so on. The thing is, with everything being public, we can doubt that the content of it is actually the truth. It's part of the truth, in a way. It's how the decision maker wants the audience, whether domestic or international, to understand their motivations. But that's basically narrative to create or gain legitimacy. It can be the real motivation. It can also not be. We don't really know. So the safest option is to get anything that is as close as to the truth, but there are primary sources. So transcript of cabinet minutes, for example, classified notes, reports from the intelligence service to the decision makers, the comments of a decision maker to this, the order, the written orders sent to the embassies, military, and so on, notes exchanged between the prime minister, the head of state, cabinet minister, and so on. So everything that captures the process leading to the decision, and usually those documents are classified afterwards. They are meant to remain secret, so we can assume, because they are meant not to be released, we can assume that they are very close to the truth. So that's the kind of documents I use. Of course, I also used public documents like public interview, TV speech, TV interview, speeches, and so on, to compare what was said publicly to the audience, what was said also internally, to compare the disparities. So that's the documents I used. I used, and roughly that's over 1,000 of them. So in terms of to give a comparison, that represent more than 10,000 pages in Word format that I analyzed and encoded, because of course I didn't do it alone. I use what's called mixed method approach to critical discourse analysis. So I do both quantitative and qualitative analysis of my documents. And I must stress that what I do is not content analysis. I don't do automated content analysis. So I'm not looking just for specific words, but I'm looking at narrative structures within the text to track any implicit ideas. So sometimes I'm looking at, depending on the codes, I'm looking at words, I'm looking at sentences, paragraph, grammatical structure, for example, that would indicate the idea of nostalgia, like the used of past tenses for the verbal construction with the idea of redoing something. So looking at words like again, or the prefix re, like redoing, and so on. I do this with the help of a software that's called QDMiner that helps coding, doing the quantitative analysis. And by coding, I mean transforming hypotheses into questions that I want to ask the text, and then indicators. So for example, a question would be, what status do decision makers give to their own country? And then I have a list of options like great power, medium power, regional power, and so on. So those are the codes. And for each of them, a set of idea words that would correspond in the text to this idea. And as soon as I find this in the text, then I use the specific code to flag what I'm reading. And afterwards, the software provides the quantitative analysis, like the frequency I find an idea in the data set, and also co-occurrences. That means what codes appear together disappear together. When one code appears, is found, what other codes automatically appear or are linked to it and disappear and so on. So I can, I'm confident in identifying how narratives are structured. With the software, it's the coding is systematic. It's the same coding dictionary for all the cases. I have a coding protocol to make sure every document is coded exactly the same way. So I can have confidence in the results. And the coding has been done like this. First, with a representing sample of a data set to check first the coding dictionary that has been constructed around all the arguments found in the existing literature, plus my own intuitions and research hypotheses. Then I'm based on this first step, I've reworked the coding dictionary if some elements or indicators were not concrete enough, was unclear, too broad, if codes didn't work, or if simply by reading the text through this first coding phase, I had other ideas. So it's a flexible coding dictionary that evolves through the coding. And then I code all case by case. And then after I finish coding all the cases, I recode everything to make sure my coding has not changed because of practice, tiredness, and so on. And then I proceed to the analysis.
And let's do the same here. Let's proceed to the analysis. So obviously, I think this is a good moment to mention that I'm going to ask you about the case studies, but we're not going to be able to go into as much detail as the book does. So for listeners, this is the highlights version. Anything you hear that you're intrigued by, please read the whole book, because I promise there is a lot more there. But moving to the first case study of France's decisions in Indochina from 1945 to 1947, what did you find that the nostalgic virility idea helped make sense of?
Yeah, first, I must stress that I took this specific period because I didn't want to have the idea of Cold War to interfere with the results. Because as soon as you had the Korean War, France moved towards the Cold War framework, fighting against communism. But this argument explains why France stayed so long in China. 1945, 1947, the idea did not exist. So that's why you have a real reason why going there at first. That's why I took the 1947 is when the French decision maker officially acknowledged they are at war. So that's just wanted to precise this because for the other cases I took the entire crisis, but for France I took a specific years. Just to highlight what I found was the most interesting point is that this period of time highlights a turning point in European history and especially in French history. It highlights the changing of mentalities and values. I found a position between those who thought nothing would change after World War II, like Indochina is a colony, it belongs to us, the war is over, we are going there, and we are going to do that just before, reestablishing order and everything will be fine. So no change. And those who had the sense that something new was happening and that World War II was just not like another war, something basically completely changed, and that there was no coming back to the world pre-World War II. And I found this change with the idea of nostalgic virility. It's nostalgic virility really structure the decision to send the military immediately after World War II, despite the very difficult situation in France was. Everything was still rationing. France was trying to reconstruct everything, rebuild and everything, and more thousands and tens of thousands of soldiers were sent there. And it was structure, nostalgic virility was first present right from the start with De Gaulle and the idea that it's time to reestablish France as a great power, using this to show that the defeat against Germany right from the beginning of World War II was a mistake or something that was not meant to happen. So it's time to show our strength, show also in a sort of civilization idea that we have to go there to develop the country. So it's the idea of the still the idea of liberalism that started the colonial process in the 19th century. And through the evolution of the war, there is the idea that nostalgic virility structure the divide between this change of mentalities, especially found in the opposition within government and within the military. For example, you had an internal opposition on how those who think, who thought they had to punish severely those joining Viet Minh, and those thought that, well, we can't do something. We have to find a new way. You had those basically looking only at the past and those looking at the future and thinking war or military actions would not help French interest, and more an economic approach would be more feasible. And those who were in favor of this light approach were criticized as being cowards, effeminated. So all the idea of downgraded masculinity. So it's how I would describe the most surprising element I found for this case.
Hmm. Thank you for highlighting the surprising element. I think that always gives particular insight. Can we move then to the second case study, the British actions in the Falkland Islands? What does the framework tell us about this?
Well, actually, that's my favorite case study, so thanks for asking me about it. I think that case is particularly representative of shortcomings of traditionally used arguments. So those who have wrote before about the Falklands War either brought two sets of major arguments to explain why Britain went there. First, there was the idea that it was for economic reason. It was thought that there would be oil around, and the idea was, well, the British go to war there to secure the oil. So war for economic reasons. That's the first set of argument. The second is taking into account the political situation Margaret Thatcher was, and the idea was, well, she went to war for to safeguard her political career, so winning a war to win the election. That's the diversionary theory of war. And actually, when I studied the documents, I found that it was exactly the opposite, that this idea did not work. Regarding the economic argument, documents clearly show that the government, in fact, wanted to do the exact opposite. Given they wanted to give sovereignty over the Falklands to secure the exploitation of oil. They thought it was not economically viable to stay in the Falklands, and they were ready to hand over the sovereignty, I mean, not Thatcher, but her government, in exchange of economic deals for the exploitation of oil. And regarding the diversion theory of war, I found elements that some were afraid of losing their political career, but not Thatcher. Those who were afraid of it were her minister, while in fact she simply never cared about it. Nothing she wrote about it refers to this. So this commonly assumed idea simply are not present within the data set. So they don't work. So we need to think something else, to find something else. And what was mostly present, so by mostly I mean in over more than 52%, if I recall well the stat, more than 52% of British declassified documents, you have a combination of re-establishing a British great power status with the idea of punishing the aggressor because he was morally wrong. There is the idea of downgraded verity in Thatcher discourses. When she talks about Galtieri, she talks about him as a pervert because he sends his Argentinian forces unprepared to the Falklands without in proper argument equipment. She qualifies him as how is it in English? Have a French word, but in English has a sort of Kinder Playground Dictator. So this idea of we are above everything. The other one is below everything. We are going to solve that problem, that medical problem that could corrupt the world immediately. So it's mostly nostalgic virility that drove the British to war to protect international law, world order, the place of the UK in the world, and for moral values.
Having read that chapter, I'm not surprised it's your favorite case study, because it really does have so many components to get into. But I don't think it's necessarily, I mean, I don't think there's anyone that's like the best compared to the other. They're all really quite interesting. So can we talk about the third one, the US decision to invade Grenada?
This one has been the most difficult to write, simply because of access to the documents. That's the funny thing, not funny at the time, but now it's funny to think about it. Thing of being a researcher, because I arrived in the Ronald Reagan Foundation library during the shutdown, because it was Trump administration, and I was thinking how long is going to last. I have a flight back. I'm going to have to come back again. And so that's, you know, the uncertainty of getting access to the results. Then the archives were just messy, because the practice is to store the documents in the exact order they have been received. So if a civil servant hands over a messy data set, the archive is just messy because it's the order they received it. So sometimes I spend hours reconstructing documents with one page in a box, the other half, two boxes below, and documents are still classified about this, and I'm not planned to be declassified. So that's why that has been the most difficult, and that's why the conclusion I made there are quite cautious, because I'm not sure I know that everything has not been classified, and depending on what remains classified, maybe the theory does not work. But for now, it works. The common literature says Reagan went there because of communism. Yes and no. The idea of fighting communism has been seen, of the idea that the USSR was planning something because they were massing data, massing weapons there. That has been found, that has been present, but after the war, as legitimation process, there has been pictures of all the military equipment found, so the Reagan administration could say, see, we were right to go there, here is what we found, had we not intervened, there would have been a war somewhere else, so you were wrong to criticize us. But what has been mostly found is the idea here also of moral deviance of a regime, because the regime is a dictatorship after a coup, bloodbath coup. The idea it's communist, so it's punishing the deviant actor part was the one of the strong argument, and brings back to nostalgic virility. There was the idea of also satisfying what I call, thinking of at the Roman time, bread and blood, so to satisfy the population by giving them a bit of blood, a victorious military intervention to show, well, see, we are the United States, we can't lose, we are still strong, just to make the world forget about what has been a disastrous Carter presidency, at least from a Reagan perspective, with a fiasco of the Iranian hostage crisis. So a brutal display of force to demonstrate to the American public that their country was and continued to be the most powerful. I mean, they sent for this one aircraft carrier strike group, one amphibious assault ship strike group, the Navy SEALs, the Rangers, the airborne divisions, all of that for an island smaller than Washington, D.C. And then there was, again, nostalgic virility found after the conflict, with the idea, now we have taken care of a threat, we are going to rebuild everything. It's the idea of kind of the country is a child, we are the adult, we are going to educate them so that will never happen again. But once again, these are the conclusion we can make with the current documents available. So if the US administration decides to declassify more documents, maybe these conclusions need to be reassessed.
Well, that will be interesting to keep an eye on. And speaking of keeping an eye on, not just for that case, but more broadly, can you speak to some of the implications of this research, both in terms of theory and sort of current conflicts?
Oh, yes, of course. That's what I tried to write about in the conclusion. I wanted to, and I hope that the reader will think that nostalgic virility is an interesting concept to apply to the world today, especially in a changing world when the West is criticized by what has been said, the Global South, or said differently, the BRICS, old civilizations that are coming back and want to reaffirm their place in the world. I'm thinking about Russia, China, Iran, Turkey. All of them contesting in their way the international order established by the Western powers after World War II. So I think nostalgic virility fits well within this context. But more broadly, nostalgic virility can also apply for domestic politics, such as Donald Trump policy towards Mexico, illegal immigration, or even today. I couldn't write about it because the book was already done when it happened, but there is a nostalgic virility part in Netanyahu discourses when he says he's going to whip out Gaza and Palestinian. It's the idea of reestablishing what he thinks as Israel as a regional superpower. And so I wanted to provide something a bit new that I think matches currently well the current context we live in, and a concept that is also quite flexible. Because if you remember, when I talk about the components, that's the minimum definition. But I expect we have other elements that could be added depending on the culture, on the region we are studying. If we take Netanyahu, Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump, Recep Erdogan, we will find all the five elements I highlighted before, but at the very least. But I also expect we will find other specificities. But at least as long as you have a fuzz element, they can qualify as very nostalgic, very leaders. And if we look at speeches, even in liberal democracies, this idea that I found in the three cases as I studied, like understanding that the conflict we are is in fact an element of a much broader thing, like civilization versus barbarianism, democracy versus dictatorship, sovereignty versus inference, rule of law versus authoritarianism. All of those elements are found in the discourses of all the countries of the current cases I just mentioned. The idea of contesting legal and morally wrong norms, or that is seen as morally wrong norms, are also present. And I would say if nostalgic verity present exactly the same way anywhere, probably not, but at least we would find element in any leaders that contest the existing order. We can even probably apply the concept of strategic virility within domestic politics with populist leaders within France, for example, or in any European country with populist leaders when they talk about the EU. For example, so
Yeah, so lots of places to look out for it. A useful framework in that sense as well. You've taken us really from the past into kind of the present and the future. I wonder if on that same note of the future, you could answer my last question. Now that the book is available for people to read, what might you be working on next?
Well, actually, I'm working on several projects. The one that I'm currently well engaged in is studying international perception of international order through the lenses and eyes of those who contest it. So I've published articles and book chapters looking at more in depth of the Chinese contestation of international order that was a bit present in the conclusion, but I have working on Chinese impression of human rights, international law. I have a chapter going out soon about comparing Russia contestation of international order in Ukraine with China in South China Sea. I'm finished collecting a data set of Iran and North Korea and how they talk about the nuclear deals. So that may come next. And I'm also working on currently on the comparison on two things. First, how BRIC countries see the national order, because we have the idea, because it's called BRICS, they are a monolithic thing. So I wanted to see if BRICS share the same view on Ukraine war, for example, or international law, just to see what are the similarities, differences. And from there on, is it a very monolithic alliances, or is it going to have divergences later? So basically the question I want to answer about the BRICS is, can they be a platform for an alternative, or is it just saying no, we want more? It's something to say no to the international order, we want a bit more. It's different than saying we want something very, very different. And related to this, something that should be finished during the summer is a comparison between NATO and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization understanding of security in the context of the Ukraine war. So what security means for NATO countries, what security means for members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
All right, well, lots of interesting topics there. So much to look forward to. Thank you for the sneak previews. And of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing while you work on all of that. The book is again titled Nostalgic Virility as a Cause of War, published by McGill Queen's University Press. Matthew, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.